God has a plan for humanity, but does he have the humility to carry it out? Now, that's a very provocative question, and we will examine it on this week's episode of the Faith by Reason podcast. Welcome to the podcast. The website behind it all, as always, is faithbyreason.net. There you will find our categories and our archives of all the blog posts that I've done over the past 7 years. You will find our social media links, and you will find this very podcast. So we have discovered the meaning of life. The meaning of life is to be with God forever. And it is a pretty spectacular destiny that we talked about a couple podcasts ago. But in order to be with God forever, you have to be like God, meaning we have to be always and completely right and just. And the first step to doing that is to be always and completely right. And we talked about this in the last podcast, that there actually is technically a way for us to always be right. And that way is to take every thought we've ever had and every thought we will have and actively try to prove it wrong. And if you are unable to prove that thought wrong, then you can be reasonably sure that it's right. And we call that contrastive thinking. Contrastive thinking is being willing to consider the possibility that you might be wrong. It doesn't mean you're wrong. It means you are willing to consider the possibility that you could be wrong. And the biblical term for contrastive thinking is humility. So every time in the Bible where you see humble or humility, just substitute contrastive thinking and you'll be pretty accurate. So that's how we can be right. But how can we always be right? Well, the way to always be right would be to have all the information that exists, which of course none of us have. However, God has all the information that has ever existed because God is the first cause of information. He's the first cause of everything, including information. So in order to always be right, we would have to be willing to completely turn our will over to God, and every decision that we make, every thought we make, we'd have to get it from him. Or at the very least, be willing to run every thought by him and make sure that it is right. And if we did that for the rest of our lives, with every thought we had, we got it from God or ran it by God from the moment we were born until the moment we died. Well, then once we gave up this mortal coil and our bodies went into the dust, we would go straight up to heaven and say, hey, God, you know, you can move over off your throne and let me sit there because, you know, there are two of us now. We're both God. We're both always and completely right. But the problem is, while that is theoretically possible, it's practically impossible because it's not our nature. Number one, to be always and completely right and just, and it's not in our nature to subvert our will to someone else. We talked about that a few podcasts ago when we talked about the nature of man and why we do the things we do. So it's theoretically possible to always be right on our own by, you know, using God as our barometer, but it's practically not possible. But here's an interesting question. As I said, the biblical term for contrastive thinking is humility. That's the way you can be always right. But we know that God is always right. God is completely righteous. So if being contrastive, if being humble is part and parcel of being right and God is always right, then the question is God humble? It's interesting because humility is not an aspect we normally associate with God. When people describe God, they'll describe, you know, he's powerful, he's all-knowing, he's all-powerful, he's loving, he's compassionate, he has wrath and he has judgment, and he is great and holy and magnificent. We think of all these terms to describe God, but I rarely, if ever, have heard anyone describe God as being humble. Is God humble? And the answer is, I believe God is humble. Not only do I believe God is humble, I believe he demonstrates it in a very profound way. In fact, I believe our entire history, the entire history of man on this planet, is a history of God demonstrating his humility in the ways that he interacts with man. What do I mean by that? Well, let's keep in mind that God's goal is for us to fulfill the meaning of life. God's goal, the reason he created man, is again for man to be with him and to be like him. But of course, man can't really do that on his own. So God has to have a plan, a methodology that he can put into place to achieve that goal. Otherwise, it would have made no point to create everything and to create man. So God has a plan and a methodology to get us to the point where we can fulfill the meaning of life and be always and completely right, just like him. And that plan is right. It has to be right because it's from God, and God is always right. So the plan is always right. So God, in theory, should just, as soon as he makes man, as soon as he created the first man, he should have just implemented his plan, right? And said, okay, here you are, man, and now I'm going to unilaterally implement my plan and my methodology to get you to be just like me. That would have been right, but it wouldn't have been just. Why do I say that? Well, let's say God did it. Let's say God created man, and then he immediately used his methodology to make us like him. Because he would have to change us. Let's just be honest and be real. It's not our nature to be always and completely right and just. God would have to make some type of change in us, and he'd have to make that change. So let's say he did that, and he made that change, and we were up there in heaven, and we could say, hey, God, you know, I appreciate being here in heaven. It's awesome being like you. But how do you know I wouldn't have chosen to be like you on my own? Why did you have to change me? I mean, it's great that I'm up here and I'm all changed, but, you know, how do you know that I wouldn't have chosen to do it on my own? And that's actually a legitimate question, because, as I said, it is theoretically possible for man to choose God on his own without being changed, without God using that methodology. Now, that change, by the way, is what we call salvation. And I'm not going to go into detail on that. That's something way, way down the road. And if you want to know what my thoughts about salvation are, you can go to the blog, look under the category of Jesus, and yeah, read those blog posts, and you'll see what I have to say about salvation. But it obviously involves a change of our heart. But again, as I said, it's theoretically possible for us to choose God on our own. Practically impossible, but theoretically possible. And God would be unjust not to give us that opportunity before he unilaterally implemented his plan. So what I believe God has done, and I think it's pretty easily demonstrable, is that God has given man every reasonable opportunity. He's in the process right now of giving man every reasonable opportunity to choose to be like him on his own, to choose God on his own. And again, I believe that is the process that we're in right now, and that is the story of our entire history, the 6,000-7,000 years of recorded history, is God being contrastive. God contrastively proving that his plan, his methodology, is the only one that's right by giving man every opportunity to choose God outside of God's plan and methodology, meaning salvation. Of course, as I said before, God's plan is right, but God's still being contrastive. It doesn't mean he's wrong. God's not wrong. He's always and completely right. But God can still be contrastive, because contrastive thinking is not being wrong or thinking that you're wrong. It's being willing to consider the possibility that you're wrong, even if you know you're right. And God knows he's right, but he's being contrastive. He is giving us the opportunity to prove him wrong. And of course, we have and will and will continue to fail at it. But how does this work? Well, here's how it would work. Basically, God would have to put man into a situation where he has the opportunity to either choose God's way of doing things or choose his own way. And if and when man chooses himself over God, well, then God would have to give him another scenario with another choice to choose God over him, to choose himself or to choose God. And he'd have to do that over and over again until he again has given man every reasonable opportunity to choose God, to choose to be like God on his own. And once he fails at that, then God can justly implement his plan, because he can say, you know what, man, I've given you, you know, every reasonable opportunity to do it the right way. You can't do it on your own. And so now here's my methodology and here's my plan to implement the meaning of life. So our entire history consists of certain historic eras where God puts that situation forth, where man has the opportunity to choose God or choose himself. And I'm going to call these eras, these periods of time, dispensations. Now, I know dispensation has a lot of religious baggage attached to it. And some of you might be thinking, okay, I get it. You're a dispensationalist. No, don't do that. I am not a dispensationalist. I don't buy into all of the doctrine of dispensationalism. The reason I'm using the word dispensation is because it's a familiar word, is a familiar term that most Christians know and understand. And it doesn't mean that I buy into all the doctrine. I mean, it's the same reason I use the word Trinity. You know, Trinity is not a word found in the Bible, but when I say Trinity, people know what it means. It means Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, all three as God. And so I use the word Trinity, even though it's not a biblical term. Same thing with tribulation. I use that term on the blog, even though it's not the correct term for that last seven years of man's history, of man's rule on this earth. Is called the tribulation. That's what Christians tend to call it, but that's not the biblical term. It's called the 70th week of Daniel, or the time of Jacob's trouble. Those are some of the biblical terms for it, but there is no place in the Bible where that period of time is called the tribulation, or even the great tribulation. That even though Jesus describes that the last 3.5 years of that period of time as a time of great tribulation, but that's not the proper title of it, which is interesting because people who believe in a post-tribulational rapture, and I know I'm getting a little off topic, but that's what I do. The concept of the rapture is that at some point in time, Jesus is going to come back to earth and claim his, you know, his followers, those who have died in Christ will rise first, and then the people who are still alive will be caught up together, harpazo, that's the Greek terminology for the word rapture. And there's a huge, huge debate in Christian circles about when this so-called rapture happens, if it happens at all. Some people say it happens before this 7-year tribulation. Some people say it happens at the midpoint of the tribulation. And there's some people who say it happens after the tribulation. And the people who say it happens after the tribulation use Matthew 24, the Olivet Discourse, where Jesus says, you know, after, I forget the chapter exactly, I don't have my Bible open in front of me, but I'll put it in the show notes, maybe. But Jesus says, after the tribulation of those days, you know, I will gather my elect together. So the people who are post-tribulationalists say, well, it's pretty obvious. Jesus clearly says, after the tribulation. So how can you believe anything other than after the tribulation? Well, the problem is that Jesus does not call that period of time the tribulation or even the great tribulation. He describes it as a time of tribulation, but he doesn't give it that proper name. So you can't really use that as your doctrine of, you know, of when this so-called rapture happens. And I'm not saying that they're wrong. I'm just saying that you can't use the word tribulation in Jesus' terminology of that period of time as a marker of when it happens. So the point is that I use the word tribulation not because it's accurate, but because it's familiar. Whenever you say tribulation to a Christian who knows anything about eschatology, then they know you're talking about those last 7 years of man's rule on earth before the so-called millennium. And I'm doing the same thing with dispensation. You know what dispensations are. There are a set period of time where God deals with man in a certain way, under a certain set of circumstances. It doesn't mean I buy into all of dispensationalism. It just means that I'm using the terminology because you'll probably understand it. And it's easier for me to say than a set period of time over and over again. So that's why I use dispensation. And so kind of let go of your religious baggage. And by the way, even though it was just a tangent I went on, if you are interested in learning more about the rapture, it's a very, very fascinating study. Go to faithbyreason.net and go to the category of the rapture. And there are some posts there where I kind of do a deep dive into all the theories around the rapture, whether there is a rapture and when it happens, if it does happen. So go there and check that out. So back to dispensations. I believe there has been 7 of them, which is one of the things I have in common with the dispensationalists, at least as far as their terminology and time frames are concerned. I do believe there have been 7 dispensations, 7 periods of time where God has dealt with man in a certain way. But those dispensations are really based on answering that question of, will you choose God or will you choose man? Will man choose God or will man choose himself? And in each one of those dispensations or those eras of time, God puts a situation in front of man where he has the opportunity to make that choice. And when he doesn't, he goes to the next one. And they progressively build on each other. The dispensations start fairly simple and they become more and more complex as man gains more knowledge and experience. And, you know, the planet gets older and society's age, it naturally becomes more and more complex. So the first of these 7 would have to be the simplest, wouldn't it? I mean, it'd have to be the most innocent. And that's actually the first dispensation is called the Age of Innocence by dispensationalists. And I think that's a pretty accurate term for it. Because if you want to give man the opportunity, it would have to start with, you know, the first man God created. And that man would have no experience, no baggage. He'd be innocent. And so you'd want to put him in a scenario where he had a very, very simple choice to make, to choose God over himself. And that gets us to the very familiar story of Adam and Eve. And we're going to start talking about that in the next podcast. We're going to talk about Adam and Eve. We're going to talk about original sin. And it might not be what you think it. Well, it might not be what you think it is. It might not mean what you think it means, because the story of Adam and Eve is a very familiar story. And when we deal with familiar stories, we sometimes take certain things for granted. And I think we probably take for granted what the actual sin was that caused the fall of man. And we'll get into that. It's going to be really interesting. But in that scenario, you have two people who are completely innocent. They don't know good or evil. And God gives them a simple choice, to choose him or to choose themselves. And we'll get into that in the next podcast. So to wrap things up, to summarize, God is humble because God uses a contrastive method to deal with us throughout our entire history. The entire history of man is the history of those seven dispensations. We've been through six of them. I think we're towards the end of the sixth, and there's one more left, the seventh. And then God will implement his plan. But God has been contrastively dealing with man, showing that even though he believes that he knows that his methodology, his plan is right, he's given man every reasonable opportunity to do it himself, which is absolutely fair. It is just, it is right. And it's really going to, the study of the dispensations is going to take the bulk of the rest of these podcasts. In fact, I'm still working. I've been doing the podcast for 7 years, and I'm still on the dispensations. As I'm recording this podcast now in kind of early mid 2017, I'm still dealing with the last couple of dispensations. So it's going to be a long study. It'll take years, but it should, because again, it's our entire history, and there's just tons and tons of stuff to get into deeply to really understand Christian philosophy as it relates to God's plan for us and God's execution of that plan. So it's going to be some great stuff, and can't wait to dive into it. So again, wrapping things up, this is a shorter podcast, and I think you guys kind of deserve a break. The last few have been pretty long. So this is going to wrap this one up, and in the next podcast, we are going to talk about the first dispensation, the dispensation of innocence, Adam and Eve and the serpent in the garden, and it's going to be great stuff. So until then, make sure you subscribe to the podcast, subscribe to the blog, follow me on social media, and I will talk to you next week.